And we'll spend some time looking into the Word of God together tonight. In the book of Exodus, obviously. Book of Exodus, and we'll start at the beginning. Chapter 1, for those of you who came in just after we started. Glad you've made it tonight. Welcome to all of you. Really glad you're here. And you've come at a good time because we're just starting a new series as we sort of start the new year together. We're going to be spending a few weeks, God willing, if he wants to change things, he's welcome to do that. But the way I'm looking at things is that we'll be spending a few weeks looking in the book of Exodus, second book in the Bible. We'll read possibly the first chapter and a bit of the book this evening. Exodus chapter 1. These are the names of the sons of Israel who went to Egypt with Jacob, each with his own family: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah; Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin; Dan and Naphtali; Gad and Asher. The descendants of Jacob numbered 70 in all. Joseph was already in Egypt. Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died, but the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous, so the land was filled with them. Now then a new king, who did not know about Joseph, came to power in Egypt. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become much too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Pithom and Ramses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with hard labor, in brick and mortar, with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their hard labor, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, "When you help the Hebrew women in childbirth and observe them on the delivery stool, if it's a boy, kill him. But if it's a girl, let her live." The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. Then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, "Why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live?" The midwives answered Pharaoh, "Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They're vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive." So God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all the people: "Every boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live." Now, a man of the house of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her slave girl to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying, and she felt sorry for him. "This is one of the Hebrew babies." Then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you?" "Yes, go," she answered. And the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you." So the woman took the baby and nursed him. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, "I drew him out of the water." So why this series? Why are we going to look at the book of Exodus? Well, at one level, it's simply a follow-on from the book of Genesis that we looked at for some considerable time over the last couple of years, on and off. So it kind of follows the story on from there. But the overall theme is about being set free. And when I started this week to settle down to really start to look at this and how it would work, it just struck me how the little series we're going to be doing at the first part of the year in Sunday mornings about breakthrough, and this in Exodus seems to dovetail in so well together. Both of them are about being set free. Both of them are about entering into a new experience with God. And I think God is in this for us, and I think he wants to teach us some things in this tonight. What happened, and this is the important thing for us to understand, what happened to the Israelites as we follow the story through is a great example. It's kind of a picture of what happens to us and in our lives and the way that God works in our lives so very often. The story of the Exodus is the story of the people of God, and we have been grafted into the people of God. We are part of the great family of God. What we find here is a precursor of what we find in the Gospels. It kind of runs ahead but portrays many of the same kind of things that we will see when we get into the New Testament. And in a sense then is a mirror of our own experience of being part of the people of God. So it's a very, very important book. And what I want to do tonight is just to give you a brief outline of the book that you may want to just take a note of if you're that way inclined, or tuck it away in your memory banks. It will help you break up the book as it goes through. That is very brief. And then we'll just we'll set the scene and we'll go through some of this first chapter. We'll put some flesh on it and we'll draw some application out from it. So, yes, that is meant to be blood on there, purposefully, because Exodus is a book that's full of blood, one way or another. You do know, don't you, that Christianity is a religion that is founded and rests on blood. The blood of Jesus Christ, the sacrifice for us. Blood represents life, and Jesus gave his life for us. So that will be our little motif as we go through this book. The blood on the corner, a journey through Exodus. How does the book play out? Well, here is the little outline for you. Here's one outline anyway. You could say, first of all, it's about the trip out of Egypt and following through to where they get the Ten Commandments, so that the trip, the journey out. And then at chapter 19 and 20, we've got the giving of the Ten Commandments. They are the tablets. And then after that, the tablets set out the law of God, the way that God wanted his people to live as his separate people. But when they failed, there was a consequence. And there needed to be a way in which to get their faults and their failings dealt with before a holy God. And that's what the tent is about, the tabernacle. And so as you read through the book, you get to chapter 25 through pretty much to the end. And it's really all about the tabernacle, the tent, if you like, where people were put right with God, where the sacrifices were made, where the sin sacrifices, the sin offerings, and the worship offerings of the people were made. So trip, tablets, and tent. But that's very, it's a very practical kind of thing. It's nothing spiritual to hang on. So I'm going to give you another, and I think this is a better outline for the book. I'm going to suggest to you, it's about being saved, it's about being separated, put my false teeth in. It's about separated and it's about being sanctified. Follow those two things through. The salvation is being saved, rescued, redeemed out of Egypt. And then when they get to Sinai, And we'll certainly cover this part of the story. They get to Sinai, and God says, look, if you're going to be my people, then you need to know how you're to live. You are to be different from all the nations around. You are to be separate. You're not to be like the rest. And so the tablets really explain to the people how they are to be separate. And it's the law of God that separates them. As they are to follow the word of God, they are separated from the rest of the people, the population of the world. And then the third section, we would say, is sanctified. And sanctified means to be set apart. Once you've been saved and separated, to be sanctified means to be set apart, but it means to be made and develop into the likeness of Christ, to become like him, to become like God. And so the sanctification bit is where the people learn how to live as the people of God. Saved, separated, sanctified. That may be a helpful way for you to look at it, to remember it. Three sections of the book. As I say, I think we will probably go up as far as chapters 20, 21, something like that. Because if you remember back, maybe a year ago, maybe 2 years ago, we actually did a series on the tabernacle. So much of that we've actually covered already. We could go through it again, but I think you'd probably get a little bit bored with me saying the same thing. So that's where we're going to go. Trip, tablets 10, or saved, separated, sanctified. Now, what's happened and what's going to happen? Let's set the scene a little bit. That's all you're getting in terms of pictures tonight, by the way. So don't expect anything else to happen. That's just there for you. What else are we going to look at? Let's just go back. And what has happened? Because it's important. You probably know as well as I do, most of you, what has happened. But just in case you don't. The book of Genesis ends up with the story of Joseph. Joseph was the character, Joseph and his multicolored coat. He's the brother that had been sold into slavery, and he ends up in Egypt. And in Egypt, he winds up through a very circuitous route as the prime minister. And through the divine revelation and help of God, he enables the Pharaoh to come through a time of great devastation and need in the country. 7 years, 7 good years, 7 bad years. And because of Joseph's understanding and wisdom, he's made prime minister. And there's this little story that runs through it as well, where Joseph's brothers come from the foreign, from Canaan, and they come and they have to appear before Joseph, who they've sold. And it's an interesting story, where at first he hides himself. He doesn't let on who he is, does he? And kind of plays with them a little bit. I always wonder about that. I have to say, I wonder where that fits in and why he did it. But he played with them for a little while. And eventually he tells them who he is and then says to the Pharaoh about their situation. And the whole family ends up going to live in Egypt, because there's a famine in their own land, and they end up living in the part of Goshen, northeast of Egypt. And they're very, very successful, and they live well. Joseph's actions made Pharaoh a very wealthy man, because many of the nations around, and you can read the history books on this, many of the nations around suffered the same natural disaster at the time, this great famine, and they all had to come to Egypt to buy their grain. And of course, that brings wealth in. So Joseph is a bit of a national hero. His family are welcomed into Egypt with open arms, and they're given excellent land to farm, because they're farmers. Land the Egyptians didn't really want, because they weren't a farming nation themselves. So that's what's happened. Exodus takes us on some 215 years later, when those initial 70 settlers have flourished and grown into a great nation. They are a sizable ethnic group in the land of Egypt. And for much of that 215 years, Joseph and his descendants and his contribution to national life has meant that the Israelites are valued and treated with respect. But over time, things change. As the Israelites grew in number, and as Joseph's place in history began to recede from people's minds, people's attitudes to Joseph's enlarged family begin to change. And we read in Exodus chapter 1 that a Pharaoh who did not know Joseph took the throne in Egypt. And this man, because he had such a scanty knowledge of history, and this is why history is such an important thing. Because if you don't understand history, then you're going to make mistakes of the present. And this man didn't know his history. He didn't know about Joseph. Or if he did, he chose to forget it. And all he sees instead is this ethnic minority that are hugely prosperous and increasingly influential in the land. And the respect and admiration for them changes to fear and suspicion as they see that this ethnic minority is growing big enough to have a substantial influence on the future of the nation, economically, militarily. If there should be a conflict, then the Pharaoh reasoned that if the Israelites who were in the country should join with the enemy, that would put them in a perilous position. And so he decides that something must be done about it. Isn't it interesting that fear and suspicion of immigrants and migrant minorities is not a new thing? It's not a new thing. And so the word goes out to oppress the Israelites, to reassert on them the power and the influence of Egypt. And many of them are taken from the fields and they're forced to work as brickmakers and builders. That's not their natural thing. It's not what they did. The family of Jacob were largely farmers, shepherds. They're made to make bricks and build. They are put on this vast civic building project to make these two store cities, Ramses and Pithom. They're built with this conscripted labor force. Well, the idea that it would subject them, that maybe they wouldn't flourish quite so much. But of course, this is God's people. And the more you suppress God's people, the more they flourish. And again, if you know your history, you know this is what always seems to happen. You can't see it in the midst of it, but you look back over time and you see where God's people and the church is suppressed. That's where it comes out, and that's where it starts to flourish. And that was what was happening here. Despite the oppression, God's people still flourished. So failing the hard labor regime, they decide to keep the hard labor, but they will also bring in Plan B. And Plan B is nothing less than genocide. As the Israelite midwives are given the order to kill every male baby on birth. Thankfully, the two midwives that are named here, Shiphrah and Puah, are made of better stuff. And they agree together not to do this order, not to carry out the command of the Pharaoh. If you're looking where that is, that's verse 16 and 17. It says, because they feared God, did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. Wonderfully courageous women. Why? They respected God more than they feared Pharaoh. They delighted in God. They were more concerned to do what God wanted them to do than what the Pharaoh said. They valued the integrity of God, the people of God, more than their own lives. And so they didn't obey. And when they're called to give a reason for it, I don't know whether they were making this up or whether it really is what happened. I suspect it's really what happened, that the Israelite women gave birth quickly. they were blessed by God. They were multiplying. They clearly didn't have the same levels of difficulty in childbirth as the Egyptians did. They may well have been telling the truth rather than just making up a story. Anyway, in desperation, Pharaoh orders his own people then to join in this genocide and to kill any baby that they find by drowning them in the River Nile. But even now, we find that there are three other women. Love the way that God uses women in the Bible. There are three other women prepared to defy the king's, the Pharaoh's edict. Chapter 2 introduces us to the man we know as Moses. But behind Moses stands these three women. The first is his mother, Jochebed. She's not named here, we know that from elsewhere. And like any other mother, Jochebed could not think of anything but trying to save her newborn son. She kept him secretly at home for a while until it was no longer possible to keep him quiet and to keep him amused within the confines probably of their one-roomed home. And she comes up with a desperate, and it was a desperate plan, in which she makes a basket, covers it with pitch, decides to float it on the river, leaves it in the reeds. I don't know what she was hoping to do with that. Have you thought, what was she hoping that it would achieve? She puts him in the reeds and gets her older sister Miriam to stand guard from a distance. Maybe she was hoping that if someone found him, they'd take pity on him and take him home. In other words, she'd rather give him away than see him die. Anyway, it's none other than Pharaoh's daughter that comes along and finds this little basket in the reeds. I wonder if that was part of Jochebed's cunning plan. I wonder if she knew that Pharaoh's daughter would go down to that part of the river to bathe. It's quite likely. But we don't need to put our theology on things that may or may not have happened or reasons. But what we do know is that the princess was struck with the beauty of this little child. And hearing his pitiful 3-month-old cries, it seems that Pharaoh's daughter, the princess's maternal heart, takes over. And she takes pity on him. And it's clear to Miriam, the sister who's standing guard a little way away, that actually there's a possibility that some good can come out of this. So she comes up to Pharaoh's daughter, bold as brass, and says, "Do you want me to find a nanny for him?" I mean, this is Pharaoh's daughter. This is like going up to Kate, you know, and William, and saying, "Oh, you're having a baby. Do you want us to go and find someone to look after it for you?" Pharaoh's daughter says, "Great idea. I think that's just what we need. I know somebody." You know the story. She goes and gets the baby's own mother. And the mother gets paid for looking after the son. Isn't that great? The only part of it from that's not quite so marvelous for the mother is that while she gets paid to bring him up, when he's old enough, she's got to let him go to live in the palace. But I think she'd rather have that than have her baby boy killed. It's a great story. And we've got four ordinary women, each playing their part in the work and the plans of God. But what of Moses, this little boy that we know who grew up to be called Moses? Well, we really don't know much of his childhood and of his time in the Egyptian family. He was treated as a child, as an adopted child of the princess, we do know. There's a lot of evidence in the history books, the secular history books, that Moses probably grew up and was trained as a military leader and had a place of great influence. That would certainly perhaps bear out some of his actions later on, but doesn't explain everything. The next we see of Moses, though, once he's been taken to the Pharaoh, the next we find is where we stopped reading. From verse 11 onwards of chapter 11, what we find of Moses is that he goes out from the palace one day and he sees an Egyptian beating an Israelite. And he intervenes and he kills the Egyptian and buries his body, hoping that nobody's seen what he's done. The next day, he goes out again to walk among his people. He knew who he was. He knew he, although he's brought up as an Egyptian, actually he was an Israelite. And he goes out among his people. And he sees two of his own people fighting. And he tries to break up the fight. Only to be horrified when they say, "Who do you think you are? Coming out here like the big I am. You're going to kill us like you killed the Egyptian yesterday." And in that moment, Moses' world is shattered. Because what he thought had been done in secret is now exposed. If these Israelites know about it, then it's only going to be a matter of time before Pharaoh gets to hear about it as well. And so he takes flight, literally. And he runs to the desert area of Midian, where he exchanges the life of an adopted prince to take the work of a shepherd. He finds a wife. They have a family. And he settles down in this area for 40 years. Very little's heard of him. Meanwhile, back in Egypt, God's people continue to cry out to the Lord for rescue. They call on him. The Israelites groaned, it says at the end of chapter 2. The Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to the Lord. And God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. We'll take up the story from there next time. What do we learn, though, from this slice of history? From this narrative, this part of the story of God's people, what do we learn? It struck me as I was reading this how God's plan to rescue his people had a very fragile beginning. Almost as it were, hanging by a literal thread. The threads that bound together, maybe, the little basket of Moses in the rushes. The thread of a mother's courage, the thread of the courage of Pua and Shiphrah, the midwives. The courage of Miriam to stand guard and then to go out to Pharaoh's daughter and say, "Do you want me to get a nanny for him?" Moses' mother, Jochebed, who had the courage not to expose the birth of her child. And then at the other end of the scale, the princess, Pharaoh's own daughter. These women who were used in the work of God. People, we don't know about the princess, but certainly the other ladies who chose to trust God rather than submit to evil. Does it remind you of anything? Does it remind you of any part of the Bible story? How about the birth of Jesus? The great rescuer, because you know that Moses went on to be the leader of his people. Jesus, the great rescuer. A vulnerable baby. Not in a papyrus basket, but in a manger. Cared for by a young teenage mother. Jesus, a baby, a helpless baby. Hunted by a despotic ruler, but protected by ordinary people. That's how God's plan of salvation started. Could easily have, What if she'd have dropped the baby? What if she hadn't have coped? It was a huge risk, wasn't it? And then when we go off a little bit longer in the New Testament, we get to Paul writing to the Christians in Corinth. And the church is just starting. The whole church hasn't been going that long. But this infant baby church in Corinth. And he talks to them and he writes to them and he says, look who you are. God doesn't call the important and the significant and the powerful. And you read in Corinthians chapter 1 that it says in 26, it says that God chooses the weak things. The things, the people that the world considers to be nothing. The people that others would put on a scrap heap, they're the people that God chooses to use in his kingdom. Take a step back. Think of the apostles that Jesus called. There was Peter, who belonged to a terrorist organization. Sorry, Simon, who belonged to a terrorist organization. Simon Zelotes. And there was, and this organization would have hated the Romans. And there is Matthew, who worked for the Romans. I'd love to have been privy to some of their discussions. There was James and John, two brothers, fishermen. But they had nicknames. The Sons of Thunder. I wonder why. What kind of people were they that they would be called the Sons of Thunder? Would guess they were probably fairly meek and mild and gentle, probably never raised their voices. There was Thomas. Oh, I don't know. You know it's going to work out bad. Nothing ever good like that will happen. Always questioning, always doubting. And I can imagine him, Thomas, just for once, would you stop going on about the things that might happen? Just bit of cut, come on, man. Can you imagine Peter and Thomas together? I mean, Peter is the man, just go for it. You know, Jesus said, Joe, how high? And it's Thomas. Oh, do I have to? The things the world counts as, these weren't educated, intelligent people. In fact, in Acts, it says that they saw these uneducated people and saw they'd been with Jesus. In each of these cases, God takes a huge risk of letting everything of his plans depend on frail and fallible people. Doesn't that give you confidence and hope? Doesn't that make you grateful? Doesn't that make you think, well, maybe, just maybe, God could use me as well? God uses ordinary people in the face of overwhelming odds, but it's always been that way, and it always will. In Revelation chapter 12, there's a vision of a dragon that's poised over a woman about to give birth. And the child is snatched away to safety. It's a picture of Satan and the work of God. Satan always stands ready, desiring to thwart the work and plans of God. But God will, in his power, bring about his purposes. And Pharaoh and Satan and Herod cannot thwart the plans of God. You wouldn't think you could get those little things out of a history narrative, would you? But what grace we see of God, that here are ordinary people, and we're ordinary people. And I don't mean to insult you by saying that, but actually in the big scheme of things, we ain't going to make that much difference, are we? But God wants to take us. He wants to take you. He wants to take me to play our part. Let's just make sure that we've got the spirit of Shua and Shifra, the two Israelite midwives who would fear God more than other people. May God help us to be those kind of people for his name's sake. We're going to sing a song.